So for those of you just joining us, I'm Chaim Hirsch. I'm the new Dean of the Faculty of Computing Information Science. And I have the honor, I'm actually really excited to be able to introduce our next speaker, someone that I work very closely with and who I'm having a blast working with, and that's Jeff Hancock. Jeff is a professor in the Communications and Information Science departments at Cornell and is the co-chair of the Information Science Department, which is the context in which we work most closely. He is interested in social interactions mediated by information and communication technology, with an emphasis on how people produce and understand language in these contexts. His research has focused on two types of language, verbal irony and deception, and a number of cognitive and social psychological factors affected by online communication. Please give a warm welcome to Jeff, and please remember to text CSV14, followed by your question for Jeff to 22333. Jeff.
Happy April Fools, everybody. I must admit, when I got the email saying, hey, would you like to give a talk online on April Fool's Day? I was like, there's no chance that's real. And so I'm just glad you're all actually here. So thank you for not being a joke. Deception's a really exciting topic. It's excited humans throughout time. We can see here this fellow. Anybody recognize him with the lantern from their studies back on the hill? Diogenes, correct. What was he looking for? A single honest man dying, of course, without ever finding one. We've seen interest in deception going back as far as we can in recorded human history. On the other side here, I have Confucius, who is deeply interested in genuineness. In fact, Confucianism is a bit obsessed with superficiality. The Chinese were one of the first to come up with a deception detection technique. They actually put rice in a person's mouth. And if they didn't have enough spit, then it assumed that they were lying and they couldn't talk anymore. Interest in deception has been core for humans for such a long time. There's a lot of different reasons. Some philosophers argued it's really the trait that makes us unique relative to all other animals. The degree to which we can do it and how important it is. The reason we've been able to build all that we've been able to build is that we trust each other. And so when people lie, they violate that trust, and that's where the interest comes from. But it's also really common. Let's see how often people here in Silicon Valley lie. So it's already about 4 o'clock. How many of you here, I'm gonna get you to raise your hands, have lied in the last 24 hours? So think back, did you tell a little white lie? Did you tell a big whopper? One person's got his hand up already, fantastic. Very honest liar over there. All right, let's see, how's Silicon Valley doing? Let's see, if you've told even a little lie, you know, one of those little things, put your hands up. Very good, keep it going. Excellent, they're coming back online. Oh yeah, right, okay. Good, okay, well that's not bad. Looks like about a third of the people in the room reported lying. Make sure you identify them. Those are the liars. Do not trust anything they say. It's actually a lot lower than typical studies suggest, and I'll talk about some of them. Most people lie about once a day, with a few people lying a lot, and some people not lying very much at all. I'm sure just the rest of you forgot your lies, or you were lying to me about your lying, which is impressive. Now, I got interested in deception a little bit after these guys. This is me in 1996 as a customs officer in Canada. It was my first professional experience with deception. You can see there, you might think that's a gun, but this is Canada. I was defending the border with a stamp, so that's that's what we do in Canada. And I came to realize a lot of things. I was studying psychology, I'm a psychologist, and I came to really realize that a lot of my beliefs about deception were really problematic. And actually, I've spent the last 20 years sort of working through how deception intersects with technology. Even then, we would clear people into customs on boats and planes by telephone. And I thought this was a really crazy idea. And technology, as we know, has completely transformed how deception can work and how we communicate on a day-to-day basis. So I want to show you a couple of ways that that's occurred. Our lab's been working on new forms of deception. We'll talk about three of them today. They're called the butler, the sock puppet, and the Chinese water army. Sounds like a strange book. Would you buy it? Just kidding. And each of them is a kind of lie that we've been working on in the lab. So let me talk about the butler first. Have any of you ever said this before? Anybody ever written on my way? Yeah, then you've lied. In fact, the iPhone, one of the default shortcuts is on my way. And we're never on our way. We're always still there, thinking about getting on our way. You've probably said this, sorry, my battery is dead. I'm in a dead spot. I did that to my mom just the other day. I wasn't, got work, gotta go. What all these have in common are a response, a human social adaptation to our current always-on world, okay? We view these butler lies, and they're quite common. They make up about 20% of all the lies that we tell in a day with technology, and that equates to several million a day when you look at the billions that are sent on all the networks in America. And they're not really, they're not bad. When we've looked at them, we've done almost a dozen studies on them now, is they're really all about relationships. That is, we care about people, but we don't always want to necessarily have to be talking to them. And so there's difficulty. When I'm always available, once you have my digits, you can always technically communicate with me. Designers have focused entirely on connecting us, not on how do we disconnect without hurting somebody else's feelings. So they're very relationally focused. The next one is the sock puppet. Some of you may have heard of this. I'll give you an example. This is a book, Quiet Vendetta, by R.J. Ellery. Here's a review of it from Amazon. Great reviews. I like the last one. Whatever else it might do, it will touch your soul. It's very good. As you're probably guessing, Nicodemus Jones there is R.J. Ellery, right? So he was writing about his own work as a different person. This is identity deception. It's becoming a big issue. But sock puppetry is not brand new. Walt Whitman was infamous for this, actually. And this becomes interesting when it goes to scale, all right? And that's the Chinese Water Army. The Chinese Water Army refers to a group of people in China, many, many thousands, that will write propaganda for a small amount of money on social media. So they'll produce social media content in a groundswell of support, making something look like there's a lot of people that believe X, Y, or Z. In the US and North America, it's referred to as astroturfing, major concern in politics, for example, or more importantly, in all the reviews that we now read and rely on for everything from travel to buying a toaster. Tons of concern about, like, well, how do I believe this review of this thing by another person? How do I go about believing that? Well, all of this might lead you to think that all these changes in technology have led us to be an incredibly deceptive society, that we're more deceptive than ever before. Technology facilitates it. Well, a lot of our other studies, where we look at everyday stuff, suggest something very different. And I'm going to tell you about a couple of those studies now. And I want you to forget about, you know, those anonymous chat rooms where people get into sexual escapades. I'm sure you've never been in one, so I'll just tell you, I assure you, they've been lying in there. The Nigerian prince with 43 million, also lying to you, and we're not going to worry about him and that kind of spam. Instead, what I want to worry about and think about is the emails that you send every day, the text to your wife and to those people you work with, the phone calls, Skype, the many ways we communicate with our social network. All right, let's take a look at how lying and technology interact there. We've done a lot of diary studies that have produced some really surprising results for most people, and that is that deception is actually the lowest, and sorry that's overlapping, but people report lying the fewest times in email on a percentage basis. So email tends to be where people report being the most honest. And again and again and again, the place, the medium in which that has the most lies is the telephone. And if we talk to salespeople, for example, they're like, oh yeah, totally. The phone is the place where I do all my lying. And you're probably already starting to think, okay, maybe there's some reasons why that might be. But whenever we ask people, where do you think people lie the most, they'll say email typically, because there's no nonverbal cues. But it's quite the opposite. Resumes, we did a study where we had people apply for a job and they could either hand in a paper resume or they could do it via LinkedIn. Same questions that we asked for the information, and we even asked some headhunters what they thought. The headhunters all said, oh, well, there's going to be more lies on LinkedIn. It's internet, right? Of course there's going to be more lies. We found quite the opposite. For the things that employers actually care about, like responsibilities, skills, how long they've been in a position, more of those kinds of lies in paper resumes. And you might already be thinking, well, why might that be? Well, the network is going to be a huge part of it. And as you're going to see, the network constrains us in the way that we can lie in really fascinating and important ways. If I lie to you guys now, and Haim, who's my boss, is here, he can actually detect that. He can share that information. On LinkedIn, I would be connected with Haim, right? So the network actually starts to act as a constraint. Facebook is another good example. In this study, some researchers at UT Austin had people look at personality. And we all think, oh yeah, it's just a bunch of narcissists on Facebook, that is all these idealized versions, there's no way lives are that good, they're just self-presenting in these positive ways. Well, they had people, friends of a target, would rate the target and say, oh yeah, this person is this extroverted, this conscientious, etc. And then some complete strangers rated the same target, but only looking at their Facebook profile. And the two kinds of ratings were almost identical. So that is, perfect strangers were able to use Facebook information to get the same assessment of the personality as the person's actual friends, suggesting that Facebook profiles are actually quite revealing, quite truthful about personality. Well, what about online dating? We've looked at a lot of online dating. Some of you probably have friends that have done online dating, and those friends have told you, oh my goodness, this guy came, he had no hair, and the woman didn't look at all like her photo. Well, we're really interested because we could do this thing where people say something online, and then we could actually measure them. So we brought people into the lab, not in Ithaca. As it turns out, nobody online dates in Ithaca. That's just like, it doesn't happen. We went to New York City, board of friends lab down there. We scraped what they said on their profile. They came in the next day, and we put them up against the wall. We got their height, put them on a scale, got their weight, got their driver's license, income tax. Fantastic. Here's what kind of data, as an example. Don't worry, you don't have to see it. But here's how tall they said they were. Here's how tall they actually were. These are men. If their line, or if their dot was on the line, they were telling the truth. And if theirs off, they're fudging. You can see the men are all below, which means they're all lying about being taller, right? All the women know this. In fact, they lied about being taller by about 9/10 of an inch on average, which we in the lab call strong rounding up. You get to 4'8 and 1/10 of an inch, boom, 5'9, yeah, right? In fact, I just started looking at men's shoes. I'm going to do a study on this as soon as I get back. I think that men's heels, the average height on a men's heel, I bet you is going to be 9/10 of an inch, don't you think? All right. So we're seeing all these pieces of evidence that suggest that actually technology in our interpersonal lives are not actually that different. Okay, so we're actually seeing more honesty rather than more deception. All right, well, why might that be? Well, to understand that, I think we have to look backwards. To understand the future of line, we have to look backwards. One way to look backwards is to look at all the deception research that's been done in psychology and communication over the last 40 years. Very well-developed literature now. And there's a couple of big findings that are going to shock you. I promise they're true. First, we can't tell if somebody's lying if we see them face-to-face. We're terrible at it. We're really bad. Hundreds of studies. Next, there is actually no single cue. If I were to ask you all, you know, what can you tell, like what cue works? Everybody would say eyes. Most countries say eyes. And in fact, there is no single reliable cue. There's no Pinocchio's nose. And people lie for a reason. Just because I'm texting with you doesn't mean I'm going to start lying more. Instead, we all lie for a reason. Now, we can go even further back and look at how we started talking. We as a species started talking at least 50,000 years ago, probably closer to 500 million. But let's say 50,000. During that time, about 100 billion people have evolved. And they evolved speaking to each other like this. I mean, without the microphone, but like this. And writing didn't even really occur until about 3200 BCE, okay? About 5,000 years ago. That means that for every single one of those people before then, not one thing they said remains. Every word they ever uttered disappeared, evanescent. Even after that, you don't see the writing press, the printing press, until 1440. In fact, in World War II, half the world was still illiterate. So the majority of every human that's ever lived never left one single word, right? Now, according to Eric Schmidt, we produce, in 2 days, all the information that was produced up until 2002 by all of humanity. We're shockingly changing how much of a record we leave behind. And the record is the main way to think about how deception is going to be changed in the future. Here's an example. Remember I was talking about those reviews. Well, we produce millions of pieces of user-generated content today. Here's some examples. Our group paid for one of these, so one of them is fake. The other one is real. Which one do you think is the fake one or the real one? All right. Give you a second to read it. Show of hands. How many of you think A is the fake? Okay, about half. How many of you think B is fake? Wow, well, much more B's than A's. Well done, Silicon Valley, well done. Except for the losers that put up your hand for A. No, I'm just kidding. It's very difficult. In fact, it's almost impossible. When we get humans to try and detect these, they perform at chance, just like in everything else. We use computer software developed with Claire Carty and Mile Ott, other people in computer information science, to detect these using linguistics. You can see some of the cues here. The really cool thing here is that our language that we produce reveals psychological dynamics going on. And what I'm most excited about all this stuff around big data, about connecting objects and devices and people, is that we're leaving these records, most often linguistic records, and they can tell us things about what's going on in a person's mind or in their relationships. For example, people that didn't stay in the hotel used fewer spatial terms like prepositions, on, the, and articles, the, near, small, big, because their bodies had not actually been in the space. Now, before you get too excited and you start writing these things down and you start thinking that you've cracked the code, remember, there is no Pinocchio's nose. So we've also been finding that different forms of deception have different cues. So when we look at online dating deception, the written words there are very different that tell us about deception than these. When we look at presidents and their lies about going to war, for example, very different. We just did a huge study on scientific fraud, and we looked at articles that have been retracted because the scientists were fraudulent. Well, their writing is very different than true ones. We can detect them around 79%, but the cues are very different. It's all about readability. We can look at CEOs and CFOs making statements that then subsequently have to be retracted. There's cues there, but they're different. So there's no Pinocchio's nose, but what's different for us is we can build machine learning models for each deception context rather than one big one that applies to every deception. And the reason for that is that there's as many kinds of lies as there are truths. This is a great graphic that I saw in PARP Chart Lab by Ben Gibson. And it talks about, you know, different types of lies, from equivocations, concealments, exaggerations, understatements, Enron. And there's just so many different ways that we can lie about so many different things that there's no one way to detect deception. And that's a big change that we've been really pushing at Cornell. So to return to our main guys, they were really fascinated with deception, and their ultimate record for them was that to think about this idea of authenticity is to think about what your record is. For them, they were one of the few lucky. There is actually a record of some of the things they said. But for us, we're all leaving a record now, and that record is just going to get more and more dense and more complicated as more of the things around us get connected to us and become copyable, shareable, and analyzable. So I'm really excited to see what the future has to bring for us and our record. Thank you all very much for your attention today.
Thank you, Jeff. We have a few minutes for questions, and the first one speaks for itself. What's the best lie you've ever heard?
Wow, that's really good. I really loved your talk. That's not very good. And feel free to tell it to me as many times as you like. It's fine. I will say that my wife actually is a transparent liar. So we're starting to identify that there's a few people that give off all the traditional cues when they lie. And so my wife, she turns a little bit red and her eyes get shifty. But most people are really good at lying, so I've heard many a good lie. What's the next one here?
They're coming fast and furious. Has everything you just told us been a lie? How would we know?
Wow, these are really interesting questions I've never had. Yeah, so it's a great question. So I told you the truth about pretty much everything, although, what was his name? Robert Hansen is the US's sort of greatest spy. He was caught, and he played a game called Two Truths and a Lie with all the new spies that started. And it's a great game. You play True Truths. You have to say two truths and one lie about yourself. He was able to detect them quite frequently. Most people are not. So it's true. If I told you guys a bunch of lies, you wouldn't be able to tell right now, but you could use that Google thing and go find out information about me. And this is where another part of my record is now searchable online, so you can actually detect things in different ways now.
So here's a few new ones. What do you think of Secret?
So Secret is one of the things I've been thinking a lot about. So we, in the 90s, most of the internet was this idea of like, no one knows you're a dog on the internet, right? Because anonymity was the big thing. And I think there was a big shift, partly due to Google and more importantly, Facebook, that created sort of warranted identities. So that is, let's connect you to your real world identity. And just in the last year, we've seen a shift back towards these anonymous spaces like Secret, Whisper, and Sooth. And I think they're really important. I think of communication as having sort of an ecology of spaces now. We've always been designing and focusing on one or the other, but I think anonymous spaces are going to be really important.
So Jeff, let me ask you a question that's not on the screen so far, but sure. It's probably on the minds of some of the people in the audience who have kids. The younger population out there has a totally different thought process about social networks and sharing of information, much different than people my age. And you pointed out, and I think you're absolutely correct, that whatever they're sharing goes into a repository that remains forever.
Right.
So what happens as we roll forward? What happens as those kids doing innocent things turn into adults who have been conditioned on this notion of sharing and that record remains? What are some of the broader implications for that?
Well, I can recommend a really great book by Dana Boyd called It's Complicated. She's interviewed hundreds of young people, and one of the things that she's discovered that they use to keep that record private, even though it's public and recorded, something called stenography. I believe that's right, stenography. And that is this idea of steganography. The idea of putting messages right out in the open, but coding them so people only on the inside, with the inside knowledge, can understand them. Back in the day, they would actually put secret messages on warriors' heads. And when that warrior made it through to the other side, he could show the other ruler his message. So it was about hiding in plain sight. So children are adapting. I think they're going to be just fine. We worry a little bit about this time where we're in flux, but I think they'll be just fine.
That's super. So there's a couple of questions that have been posed that are sort of related to one another. Having to do with sort of the commercial aspect of lying. One question says, are companies like TripAdvisor implementing practices to weed out fake reviews? Fake reviews have been, you know, a real issue as social networks have been used more widely. And let's see. No, anyway, let's touch on that. I thought there was another one connected to it.
No, the answer is yes. And TripAdvisor is really, they do have a group that are dedicated to looking at fakes. But they've taken a really interesting approach. Their view is, let's just overwhelm the deception with quantity of truth. So TripAdvisor's got the most reviews of any of them, and their argument is that we're just gonna overwhelm it. And doing deception with reviews is hard and it's expensive. So that's one of the ways they do it. Other groups like Expedia and Hotels.com, they have verified sites. You actually have to purchase something before you can do that. But a lot of places are doing this, and I think it was as Jim was mentioning, a lot of social media and companies now are about connecting and having a conversation with your customer, and to do that, you want to have authentic conversations. And so there's companies like Bazaar Voice, which have a big group there that are focused just entirely on how do you keep your conversations with your clients authentic so you can respond to them the best. And I think almost every industry, I think Jim said it best, every industry now is going to be talking with their clients through social media. And so the conversation is important. I think deception detection and understanding authenticity is important for pretty much every industry now.
So a follow-on to that is there more or less lying in marketing messages than in the past? With the advent of these social networks and all of these communication vehicles, what's the trend line like?
That's a really great question. I've never been asked it in that way. There could be some marketing people here that if they have ideas on that, I'd love to hear them. The question I get asked the most is there more deception now than before? And that would be sort of consistent with this. It's a difficult one to answer, and all I can say is that every generation tends to think that the previous generation was more honest. And that's happening to us right now. We often look and say, well, the kids today are more narcissistic and they lie more or whatever. Well, you can look at trend lines and they don't correlate with social media. Narcissism tends to correlate with how much income inequality there is. Deception, I think, has to do much more with just the general human condition.
So we got just a couple of minutes left, and let me try to tie together a couple of questions about the study of lying. And people are asking, elaborate a little bit more on the study about how good we are at detecting lies,
right.
You know, those mechanisms, things of that nature. How does the field of study advance in
right.
terms of detection?
It's a really great question. So here's a piece of trivia for you. The same person that invented the hero Superwoman, Superwoman, right? Wonder Woman, thank you, Wonder Woman. Do anybody remember what her thing was? The lasso of truth? That same guy invented the polygraph. There you go, pretty cool. Same idea, right? And the polygraph has really been problematic for a long time. It's not allowed in courts in the US because it has at max, in its best situation, about 70% accuracy, which is way better than chance, but 30% of the time you're still wrong. I do think there's been a sea change in the last 10 years. Most deception work for a long time, in part because of Paul Ekman, who had this really amazing influence on deception detection research. He was focused on the face and emotion and nonverbals, microexpressions. Well, that's where everybody focused on. In fact, there's a change. People are moving away from that. Some of you may have read in the New York Times this week that there was a huge pullback on the SPOT program. So TSA was spending $1 billion training up its officers to look for suspicious microexpressions and behaviors. And the GAO just did a big review, and they're telling them they need to stop it because it's been a waste of money. What it's been turning towards is the kind of work we're doing, in which we're looking at the language. So it turns out we used to think that language was something we controlled, right? And that nonverbals were things that leaked out of us. Well, we leak in our words too. Those little words, the ofs and thes and ahs, those ones we don't control, that's where we see a lot of action to tell us about unconscious processes. So I think we're going to see a lot of movement towards natural language processing, NLP, towards understanding deception in context.
That's great. One more, and then we'll be out of time. Is it possible through all of the deception to create a serious situation like H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds that frightened millions?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think yes. I think now that we're so hyper-connected that memes, for example, spread in ways that we're just coming to understand, that idea of contagion, when you have people linked, when you have a billion people linked through Facebook, how do deceptions become contagious? I think it's a really interesting idea, and we're just at the cusp now of being able to understand how deception flows through groups and how it gets solved. But we see things like fact-checking, and it doesn't seem to necessarily stop a deception. It continues to persist.
Excellent.
So I think it's a whole new brave world for deception and deception detection.
That's great. Jeff, thanks for sharing with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you all. Have a good day.